You're listening to the On-Call Nightmares podcast, and every week I bring you conversations with technologists who spent time on call. I'm your host, Jay Gordon, and this week I bring you Ben Halpern. He's the founder of Dev, the community for developers. You can find him easily on Twitter at Ben D. Halpern, and you can easily get to his website by going to dev.to. Dev.to, and that's D-E-V.to, is a great community for sharing information and conversing with other developers, operations people, you name it. It's a really great community. I met Ben via Twitter and eventually became friendly with him, and really am glad that we were able to have a conversation about, you know, things that have happened at his website and how his group of people that have kept it together, worked together to keep it online in a pretty nasty situation that they ran into. You know, the usual stuff that we get into here on On-Call Nightmares. So, that being said, we're going to get into the conversation in just a second, but before we do, always want to remind you that if you'd like to be on the podcast, it's extremely easy. You can send me a message on Twitter at On-Call Nightmare or at JDestro. Or feel free to send an email. It's oncallnightmares@gmail.com. Well, let's get into the conversation with Ben. You're listening to the On Call Nightmares podcast. And every week, I speak to technologists who spent time on call. And this week, I'm speaking to Ben Halpern. And Ben is the founder of Dev. He, and not actually the process of Dev, but the community Dev, the Dev Community Inc. One of the founders, or is the founder, Ben? Were you the
founder? Yeah, I have two co-founders, but I was also working on it for about 2 years before the second founder came on. So okay. We sort of like, I'm sort of the founder, also the co-founder, like depending on how you think about it.
Gotcha. So you're the founder of the Practical Dev Network, Dev2, if haven't been on it, I really do recommend. It's a great place to get information about everything related to software development, operations, you name it. Anyway, he's also Canadian, and I've recently been to Canada, and let me say, it's a great place. I enjoyed it, so thank you for being Canadian. I enjoy Canadian on this podcast. And before you founded Dev, and you are just in general a software developer who writes a lot of Ruby. That's who you are. People can find you on Twitter at Ben D. Halpern. Very, very easy. That's B-E-N-D-H-A-L-P-E-R-N. And so let's talk a little bit about where you get started your career. And then we'll talk about a little about where you are now. And then we'll get into something kind of scary. But to kind of give people an introduction, Ben and I kind of met the way I think a lot of people in technology are meeting, on Twitter. And I think it's been really cool to see what you've done with that network.
Yeah, we met on Twitter. We've hung out once in real life. And of course, like, I'm only kind of interesting on Twitter because of what I've done with Dev. Like, before that, you know, it wasn't as big a part of my life in the first place, but, but it all kind of runs together because it's about community. It's about organizing online. It's about like all the little things we have to do to keep aware of the signals in software, because there's no book of how to write code. It's like an ever changing ecosystem. So,
yeah. Having very, some very help along the way.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Having a some lot help of, along the way. Yeah.
A lot of help along the way, but you never know where that help is coming from. Like, you know, you never know when your own ecosystem, your own community is your own coworkers, or it's, you know, somebody you meet along the way. It's really a journey with all sorts of different paths.
And that leads us to talk a little bit about your journey. So tell me, how did you kind of get start as a technologist?
So I'm from Halifax, Nova Scotia. Because you intro'd me as from Canada, I don't have to say that third thing. I never really know if Americans know where Nova Scotia is. I think my first introduction to computers, my friend's friend made a website for his band when I was like in junior high. I think that was like the first, my first introduction to the notion that you can do that, that like normal people can make websites. I was always like, before I trended to being kind of interested in computers in a little bit, but I don't think we even had one at home. I think we just like, you know, computers at school. It was an interesting topic to me. That was the first time that was the light bulb moment. I think, you know, when I was younger, that was very cool, but I didn't really like stick with computers. That's like kind of where I knew that was part of what I did, but it wasn't really like my forever thing from then on out.
Was it part of your secondary education?
Like post-secondary, like did I do it in school?
Post-secondary, or, yeah, like in yeah. college and stuff like that was like, yeah. Did you have a traditional, would you say IT, like software background, or did you study something kind of different?
No, I originally enrolled in school. I wanted to do a degree in marketing and a minor in fine arts. As part of the like general business, and so at that point I had never stopped like fiddling with websites, but I never thought of it as like my main thing. So yeah, I knew how to kind of make websites, not necessarily, not sure if I'd call myself a coder back then, but I knew it was kind of up my alley. And then as part of the business program, we had to take an intro to CS just in my school, which was kind of a cool opportunity to get reintroduced to that part of computers. At that point, I really got into it and thought about switching majors, but I wound up like not really actually being into computer science after I took a few more classes in it. Like, didn't really like fit my personality, my friends. I didn't have any friends in computer science. I liked it, but I didn't really like it in school and didn't really ultimately like faded from my aspirations, but I took enough to think that I'm a little bit classically educated and a little bit not. So then I basically pieced together the rest of my degree, having like switched a few more times and ultimately getting to graduate. And upon graduation, I got a job like in kind of like marketing, like as a startup, like a marketing kind of job, which I didn't mind the company. I kind of like that, but my job itself, I really, really wasn't enjoying. I thought it was a lot of like, I don't know. I didn't think I was getting to be very creative, or like, it was always a matter of like proving to someone else that something would work, like in terms of a marketing campaign or something, never just like what would actually work. So ultimately I was dissatisfied enough with that job to really start playing around with computers a lot more. And really that's when I found the, you know, it stuck for good. Like I got back into coding in more of a way that fed my style. I learned Ruby. I was doing Java in college, and it's a small difference, but I think like Ruby is a much more playful language, really fits my mind. And even though I can program, you know, in other languages, it's always been like my favorite environment, which has always helped me just choose to use that language a lot. And, you know, when I was younger and just kind of like, you know, I only knew Java and HTML, like I only knew what I'd done. So it was a good new environment. I think people who'd been in Java and discovered like a more free flowing kind of playful computing environment, as much as it has its downsides, that was big for me. And also just like I got to be more entrepreneurial. I started just kind of making my own applications, my own websites. And that's when I decided to move to New York to sort of figure things out from there. Like just, yeah.
And then you start doing, excuse me, Argo. Was Argo a place you worked at, or was it a consulting firm?
Yeah. So that's a whole long story that really connects back to all the way to what I'm doing now. So flashback, I'm like 22 or 23 or something. I'm totally broke, decided to move to New York. My brother has a place here, so I could crash with him until I figured something out. And so I took a 30-hour train because I couldn't afford a plane ticket. Like, just did the cheapest thing I could possibly do to get here. And I'm not even sure why I chose New York in hindsight. I think it's just because my brother lived here. And I'm a dual citizen, so I am born and raised in Canada, but I didn't have any immigration issues. So So I'm here. I am applying for jobs. I'm doing all sorts of things. One thing I did was post in the subreddit NYC Jobs, and that's actually when I connected with Peter Frank, who is starting this textbook exchange product startup called texts.com. It's kind of hard to say, T-E-X-T-S.com. It's surprisingly hard to say, much easier to read. Texts.com. So that was our company. I was sort of the hired gun kind of co-founder technical person. Like, it wasn't necessarily like, you know, the, even like the, actually my first job wasn't even necessarily co-founder. It was just like, hey, can you help me build this out? And then I was sort of brought in as the co-founder after the fact, and we worked on that for a while. And that's actually the company that survived. It did sort of well, but never really like took off. It like consistently grew, but just not at a pace that could really sustain itself as a real company. It was never quite profitable. Pivoted to what became Argo, which was a peer-to-peer tutoring kind of network, which was actually in the same, you know, same customer base, the textbooks to tutoring. Tutoring's a little bit more of a, tutoring's like an everlasting good. I think textbook, the whole thing was the idea to kind of arbitrage Amazon and offer like some efficiencies, but it was always a bit of an uphill battle. Tutoring was starting to go much better. But all the while I'd been working on this little side project, which started off as the Twitter account, The Practical Dev. I mean, not all the while, but like for a couple of years into the Argo pivot and stuff. So as much as that was going well, all of a sudden, The Practical Dev and then the website Dev2 started like really, like just really taking off. Like, you know, I knew it was a good idea, but I didn't plan for obvious success. I just hoped for the best. And so it started taking up more and more of my time for good reasons, but not good if you're needing to be the CTO of another startup.
Sure.
I met Jess Lee, who she was in a career change moment. She'd had experience in some marketing and some management jobs, and she'd just been through boot camp. She was looking for some kind of career guidance, mentorship, and luckily I had extra things I needed help with, and she started helping me with Dev2 and other things like that. And we clicked really well. She became like the de facto co-founder and the idea that this was going to be a business. And then everything kind of ultimately landed at the decision for Peter to join as the third co-founder. And actually we just took Argo and reorganized it to be Dev Community Inc. So that's why it all connects back. Like, I'm sort of still working on my first company, even though we switched a lot, and now my role is entirely different. Like, I'm literally working for the same organization that I was just hired on to help, you know, spec out a textbook exchange. But because I've always felt like these relationships have been really solid, Peter took a real chance on me a long time ago, and then we sort of, you know, returned the favor and took a chance on building this all out together. You know, whereas it was really having a lot of independent success, I could have, you know, kind of just quit on everybody and moved to San Francisco and or something, you know, whatever. But it was really a community effort, both with the community that Dev was becoming, and also like my own community of folks I was working with, helping out. And gotcha. So that brings us kind of to today. We turned a Twitter account into a thriving online community with a business attached and a lot of hope for the future.
So with that comes responsibilities of keeping things online. And so with that, we're going to get into some of the meat and potatoes of this podcast, which is talking about, you know, an interesting story. But before we do that, one of the things I like to do is mention the rules of the podcast. And they're very simple. And they're just because I like to have rules for this podcast. And they're very simple. One, do not incriminate yourself. And it sounds like you're your own boss pretty much. So, you know, you'll be all right, I think. But let's not incriminate yourself. Two, let's not incriminate others, because We always believe in blamelessness in our retrospectives, and three, and most of all, this is a retrospective, this podcast, so help us learn from what we've done and what you've done, obviously. So let's hear a little interesting story from being, I guess, on call. And I don't know if you have a formalized kind of on call, but let's talk about it, since you have a pretty active and thriving community that, you know, needs to be online.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're looking to become more and more formal with our on-call process. I'd say we're least formal with our on-call process when I'm available, you know, kind of like our on-call process is less formal when I'm around, so more formal when I'm not. So the, you know, de facto, I feel like when I'm involved in it, it's mostly just me trying to be available. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a startup, we are mostly hoping to generally do well with these things. And this is, we're actually at a point right now where we're trying to redefine our processes, be a little more explicit with our SRE responsibilities, and generally level up our practices. Sure. But, you know, along the way, a lot of it was, you know, especially early on, was just me trying to do the best I could. And so, you know, just, this just yeah.
People, a quick idea. How big is the staff, I guess, you have working on the site?
So including Jess and Peter, we are, well, I guess it, we have a couple part-time contractors, a couple people, mm-hmm. like, so in total, like if you kind of like, total out the full-time jobs and stuff, it's about 10 people, so like about 7 full-time employee equivalent hours worth.
Sure, so that's a lot of people to kind of identify who has to attack what, when, if you don't really have a formalized process. So I guess it's a learning thing.
And also, like, there's that's like the whole company, which is includes Michael, who does a lot of support, like non-technical support, Liana, who does marketing, you know, she handles the shop and lots of stuff like that. And then, so it's like, all in all, we don't have necessarily a large team in terms of SRE responsibilities. And we're also like, we have a couple folks who are contractors abroad, and we are very, probably more so than other companies of our size, where like we really try to be we try to follow the principle of least privilege as much as possible. So we really try to tighten the reins around who has access to, you know, fixing a lot of things that imply sensitive data capabilities and things like that. So all in all, the I'd say the total people who do any sort of on-call stuff, there's 4 of us, Jess, myself, Mac, and Andy. So so that's kind of where we are. Like, I think we are growing very rapidly as a company. We'll be hiring some more people shortly. I think we've hired about 1 or 2 people in the past year, but the things are going to grow, so it's going to really be an evolution. I think in the next year, we're going to change the face of how we do these things. But so far, it's been just us doing our best, and luckily, I think we've made a lot of good technical choices, which have helped us scale a lot more smoothly than I think a lot of companies. Like, I think we happened upon some really good architecture choices, mm-hmm. which have limited our downtime, and the issues we've had have been specifically about configuration of our services. And obviously, I think today, you know, with the cloud, like, we're not doing anything ultra, we're not doing anything, you know, hundreds of companies haven't already scaled past to this point. So we're not having to plug in our own servers or anything like that. So as much as we can, we just try to be consistent, limit our logical errors, and just follow some best practices that have been laid out ahead of us. Sure. By companies that came before us.
Sure. So let's get into the meat and potatoes. And can you tell me an incident that might have happened while you are either kind of ramping up or where you're at now, at any time specific that you can really remember where you had to be, you know, that resource?
Yeah, I think the biggest, best incident that comes to mind, and by far our biggest problem we've had in terms of uptime, was this past April 1st. So it's the incident centered around our attempt to do what seemed at the time like a somewhat simple April Fool's joke, but it was a the joke ended up being on us big time. And so the concept for our April Fool's gag this year was to change the site's font to Comic Sans, which seems simple enough. But the way we serve our pages is basically almost all traffic is served on the edge via our CDN. And so not just static assets, but like all content. Mm-hmm. And we asynchronously load any user data, like, you know, what your profile image looks like and things like that. We store a lot of that stuff in local storage. But our big sort of essential architecture decision was that everything goes to the edge and then gets served from there. So we've made some strides to improve this, but at the time, and this was only a few months ago, with the awesome decision that was, meaning that like practically even in our worst moments in terms of our database availability, our origin mm-hmm. server, like just handling traffic, like we've always had like served almost all our just general traffic pages. Like the concept of the site is just, it's mostly for, you know, reading and consuming like important information and stuff. And the ratio of reads to writes is always going to be heavily weighted on the reads. And that was kind of the initial thing. Like how often do you read on Medium versus write on Medium? You know, it's going to be heavily weighted towards reading. And we always kind of overly emphasize like reading availability for performance purposes, which also mm-hmm. works well for scaling. But in order to make this change available immediately site-wide, even though it was just a simple CSS change, we just don't do these like site-wide changes all at once very often. And we had to just clear the cache and the edge cache. Like we had to stop serving from the edge. And what we thought would happen was that it would slow down and our server would kind of have to handle a bit extra load for a little bit while, and then it would kind of like once the cache kicked back in, it would be fine.
Sure. So I guess the assumption was the cache would repopulate, you had everything, you know, surf from the cache and everything go back to normal.
Yeah. And we talked through all the concerns. Like we were very aware of what could go wrong, but we just thought that the worst case scenario was a lot less worse than it ended up being. So
okay.
We thought that like even if we served a bit of a few errors, very quickly the cache would start serving enough of the total requests that it would go back to normal. That was the expectation. And what wound up happening was that didn't happen at all. And we just couldn't, basically the entire site couldn't serve any traffic at all. Our database was locking, our you know, throughput, we were serving maybe 20% of successful pages for mm-hmm. quite some time, and this outage wound up lasting like hours. And every other time if we've had server issues, they didn't affect most pages, but this time it did because we explicitly cleared the cache globally. We ultimately, there was a combination of a few things. Things didn't go back to normal for a while, but we had to try a lot of things, and we just didn't, we wanted to be careful. We didn't want to be overly just pulling every knob and like forgetting what we were doing and stuff. So we wanted to be explicit about the choices we made to try to bring things back online. But it also, like, we had to kind of do some more counterintuitive things. Like typically in that situation, I would expect that we would want to limit we would want to reduce the length of timeout for our database, our core like Postgres database, so that there were fewer long running requests. So some of the simpler requests could start executing, and the longer ones wouldn't choke our resources. And that was a decent rule of thumb, but we wound up not really recovering until we actually did the opposite, which was just make the timeout like infinitely long and just allowing pages to take like 30 seconds to load.
So you can get your cache repopulated at that point?
Yeah.
Like, was it more about that?
Yeah. The way things were working, like we couldn't get any caches repopulated without like letting pages just take much, much, much longer than expected to load. And, you know, the whole process was kind of, it was a real learning experience, because I was the one saying, no, that's probably not right, the right thing to do, because we want to do the opposite. And, basically I said, like, that idea was proposed earlier on from Andy on our team. And I kind of said, like, no, I don't think that's right. And so we did something else first. And
was that the infinite timeout was the first idea?
It was actually, like, he had that idea, like, to lengthen the timeout. And I had the idea to do the opposite. So we tried that for a while, and it didn't work. And I'm glad we didn't forget about that and ultimately went back to that idea. And it still took a long time before things looked like they were truly healthy. And it was just a fairly brutal day. Like, I was up practically all night, kind of just like taking a look at things. Early in the morning, Anna, who lives in Russia, comes online, and she starts being helpful, but she also doesn't have the same admin privileges to actually do things. So I sort of like, at that point, I started like taking naps. Like, this was kind of like middle of the night. And things were like kind of okay. And, you know, but it wasn't worth hoping they'd be okay and fully going to sleep. And this was,
so are you on April 2nd or April 3rd at this, like, or what day of the week?
This is like, you know, like 4 in the morning on April 2nd.
So it's a full 24 hours after, like, you decide to do this thing or with the Comic Sans. And now this is the whole aftermath of, you know, you're waiting 30 seconds for pages to load, you're rebuilding your cache, your team is trying to help, but there's not much you can do.
Yeah.
So
we pinged folks from other companies who, like, it's just that, like, everyone had the same general purpose advice. Like, nobody came in with anything that was like the aha, like, that's obviously the answer. It seemed like it just was a matter of experimentation in the end.
And did you have to use some sort of crawler in order to get everything cached the way you needed to, or did you let just normal traffic do it?
Yeah, we let normal traffic do it. We weren't really in a position to have a great idea of how to approach it otherwise. It's like we'd mapped out like possible worst case scenarios, but we didn't necessarily have normal traffic seemed like a pretty solid approach, especially because it's going to wait towards like the pages that, you know, by definition, the pages that are getting traffic are the ones we need to serve traffic to. So that all like worked out, and it would have been maybe nice if we could figure out a way to reduce traffic or like reduce the load of the traffic while still populating the cache somehow. And we
gotcha. Well, you got all the way there, and you got the servers back to, I guess, a normal space, the site gets back to normal, and do you go through kind of a public postmortem process?
I believe we were planning on sending an April Fool's email. I don't think we did that. I think instead we just made the email the sort of postmortem. And this was not a, we were sort of too tired, and we were very tired, and also this wasn't necessarily a security concern or anything, so we didn't feel there was like a need to get overly detailed, so we mostly just mm-hmm. talked about how we were feeling, you know. And also, like, you know, being a website for programmers, like, we feel like the anytime we've had these issues, like, this was the worst, but we've had other times where we've just kind of had a bit of downtime and stuff, and we've always felt like if we can just talk about these things, be honest, like, just like mm-hmm. relate to the community, like, it winds up being, like, you know, better than if we hadn't had the issue. Like, it's like we can actually get some value, like, we can actually connect with the community, sort of, it's a special situation where we actually can really empathize with our users, can empathize with us, we can empathize with our users, and even, like, I was at a conference, like, shortly after, and, you know, pretty much everybody I talked to who was from the community or knew what we were doing kind of, like, actually specifically referenced the email. It's like, that was actually pretty cool. Like, I actually, like, I loved hearing that kind of thing. So mm-hmm. We sort of know that that's a thing we do in these situations, is that we just get real honest about it, real, like, real open with our feelings about how tough this can be, and then try to move on.
It's a smart way to think about it, I suppose. Just be as open as you can and transparent, and especially if you're talking to other people who are technologists. I think you'll get a lot more than if you try to serve them a line, because most people are going to see through what is, don't worry about it, or, you know, we got it.
Yeah. Well, the biggest existential threat from the whole thing was just, the longer we're offline, the worse Google thinks of us. And you know, as a website which tries to serve people, you know, they're, like, it's essentially a fully public content driven site, and mm-hmm. our relationship with the robots at Google is pretty important to us, and we know that they won't be as receptive to a touchy feely email. So our big concern with any of this stuff is always just, let's make sure we are available for the bots. And if we're offline too long, we really don't have a sense of what they're thinking, you know, like, how long until they stop indexing our pages. I know, like, you know, I'm sure they allow for a little bit of struggle in terms of these things, but we know it'll obviously affect our search traffic if we run into this too much. And luckily, though, that's never been a problem. I think we can deal with longer outages without that becoming a problem, but that's the big threat. Then that's the, like, thank goodness we everything was fine on that front.
Well, I guess there's also a benefit also to keeping everything on the edge, then, if you think about it, those being able in situations where your origin may not be available, you can always make sure that you have very high TTLs. Obviously, in this situation, you invalidated something that caused what it caused. But if your origin dies, the cool part is that if you're giving everything on the edge for the most part, you know, except for maybe some user-specific things, they might not happen, but availability of the content ultimately will be there. And if I'm right, your site's mostly all static, static CSS that's just rendered in the browser, right?
Yep. And that really is, like, the bread and butter of what we do and how we think about our site's availability, scalability, and ultimately, like, the user experience, early on, you know, it's funny that this is such a big part of our architecture for scale and availability, but early on, I was not thinking about that. All I was thinking about was the user experience. I'm a real stickler for, like, performant web pages. I'm not a patient web browser, a patient surfer of the web, as it were. And I had this feeling that, like, the most important user experience detail you can ever care about is just performance, like time for this page to load. And so that was sort of the genesis of the project, technically, in the first place. Like, you know, I'm not sure I would have taken this choice if not for this extra interest professionally in terms of web performance. And that just wound up being a really great choice. That's always been a way for it to set us apart. And it just happens to be that that's an awesome thing for availability and scale. And that's a real lucky coincidence, because if we were building, we're just not building something that's inherently hard to scale in terms of relative to the traffic. But as we grow, we take on new challenges, we take on new product ideas, they become harder to scale, but at least we have this core concept that our site's designed to deliver static traffic, and it really works.
Very cool. So if you've got any advice for someone who's on call right now, working on some sort of, you know, maybe high traffic website, maybe they're working on some software that they've built recently, what would you recommend to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think if they're on call, especially if they're running into any issues, I got to think about just being open-minded to broader ideas of how to deal with concerns. I think taking a real debugging mindset where, like, I'm not sure what's going on, but let me, like, experimentally walk through the possibilities here and immediately be open to ideas, not be too fixated on what you assume the problem is. If your first immediate attempt to solve a problem doesn't work, you know, really start taking in ideas and from abroad, from anyone in the room, technical, non-technical, you know, you never know where the insight's coming from.
Absolutely. Cool. So we're going to kind of start wrapping up. And before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to talk about just what it is the practical dev community or the dev community itself is. We've talked a lot about what, you know, you've done to build it up, but just tell us what people can do on the website and how they can get there.
Yeah. So the website, it's like a social network for programmers. You can follow programmers, you can follow tags you're interested in, you know, like Ruby or JavaScript or WebAssembly, et cetera. We really try to be a more community first version of, say, a Medium platform. So a lot of the same benefits of shared reading and writing ecosystems, et cetera, along with, you know, Reddit and Twitter and all these kind of community concepts. And we really try to build a ground up for the needs of developers, both technical, you know, we really want to sort content in terms of its specific technical nature. To help you do your job and to really help you do your job in a collaborative way with the broad community. And then also to just sort of feel welcome, find friends within the industry, especially if you're not from a CS program or a traditional background or really anything. Like if you want to develop, you know, a sense of community in our industry, we really strive to make that a core idea of what we do. We try to be inclusive. We try to, you know, solve for problems that maybe a Twitter has left as secondary ideas about just having people feel safe on the internet, sharing their beliefs and not being harassed and things like that. So that's, you know, like we're growing. We're going to serve 4 million unique visitors this month. That's not like logged in members, but that's just traffic. That's like more than 10% of all software developers. At some point, you know, come across our site these days. And, you know, of course, it's if you want to sort of grow your presence, I think like a dev profile with a few well-done blog posts is going to be more effective than maybe a GitHub page with a few projects out of context and things like that.
Sure, because you can always link in your repositories within your blog post. Exactly.
Yeah.
And combine everything.
Yeah. And we're also just like, you know, we want to be like friendly to the open web. We want to make it easy for you to cross post from your own blog and maintain your canonical URL if that's important to you. I don't think that's like, people have different ideas about how important their own presence on the web is and how they want to do it. But we really like take pride in just being good citizens for all these sorts of use cases and provide extra good tooling. I've written a few posts about like just where we want to be now in the future. And maybe I'll link those in the show notes. And, you know, and really like, you know, also on top of this, we're entirely open source. We want to build together with the community. We've had hundreds of contributions from the community itself. And just as a project, it's like fascinating. It's like we're building a social network with the community. Like we're all building this together.
Getting programmers and developers help along the way doesn't sound so bad.
Yeah, and then long term, we wanna expand what we do in terms of open source. We wanna be able to generalize our product and maybe expand to like other communities where we actually don't need to take all the data, but we can actually replicate our instance for different sub communities, like the Azure Developer Network. Who knows? Maybe they'll have their own dev instance, which is kind of owned and operated by the sort of the community or anything like that. So these are all just like, you know, I can't separate what we're doing now from what we're building towards because it's all really important to me. And I think because we're a community of programmers, I never want to like miss a chance to just kind of like talk about like the big long-term ideas.
Gotcha. Well, I want to thank you for coming on today. I really do appreciate it. Loved hearing the story about keeping that site up and just what you're doing. It's a great community. Go to dev.2 in your browser, and it's at the Practical Dev on Twitter. That's right?
That's right.
Very cool. Well, Ben, how can we find you again on Twitter?
Yeah, just that's wondering. Ben D. Halpern.
Very cool. Thanks a lot for your time, Ben. I look forward to contributing way more blogs on your network and just reading all the great content that's on there. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Yeah, great to have you on the platform and awesome to be on the show. And thanks a lot, Jay.
Well, thank you very much for listening. Once again, this is On Call Nightmares. My name is Jay Gordon. You can find me easily on Twitter at Jay Destro. You can find the podcast on Twitter at On Call Nightmare. And if you'd like to be on, send a message to either or email me. It's oncallnightmares@gmail.com. Really have been enjoying doing all these podcasts. Thank you so much. Once again, you can continue to be part of this podcast to make sure it grows and continues to be something that people can turn to learn about what's going on and people's on-call experiences. So thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time on the On-Call Nightmares podcast, where every week I bring you conversations with technologists who spent time on call.